and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Tonight I have with us Dr. Bruce Lipton, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Honeymoon Effect, but we're also going to continue talking about his work with genetics, because that's a cutting-edge field right now, and there's so much interest with the new genetic testing and everything that's going on in the world. So welcome, Dr. Bruce Lipton, and thank you so much for taking time for us.
Eva, I want to thank you for this opportunity. I so appreciate what you do in providing the world with new information at a time when evolution is necessary. We have to leave behind the limiting old beliefs that we were programmed with and move into a new and better world. And in that regard, thank you so much for your new book on consciousness. It's very, very important for people to see the new science, and you created a nice format for that. And so I thank you.
Thank you so much. I mean, geez, thank you. It kind of takes me away there. So before we get started, I know everybody probably has already heard about you and have seen at least your earlier books, but tell us where we can find you and where we can buy your books that you're going to be talking about.
Yes. Well, the website is simple. It's brucelipton.com, so that's straightforward. The books are available at Amazon or most any bookstore, and as well as on my webpage.
All right. Tell us, what is The Honeymoon Effect?
Okay. Well, my book, The Biology of Belief, was the first book that really talked about how we perceive and respond to the world really controls our biology. And I talked about the fact that in that biology belief that we've been programmed, our beliefs, our fundamental beliefs have been programmed into our subconscious mind, and that our conscious mind is the creative mind. And when I try to tell people about the difference between the two, what really came out that was interesting, because most people had an experience of this, is something called the honeymoon effect, a period in your life where you fell in love with somebody, head over heels in love. And no matter what your life was like up until that moment, the moment you fall in love, your life has a profound change. You become usually exuberantly very healthy. You have lots of energy. And more importantly, when you fall in love, there's this period where life is so beautiful that you can't wait for the next day to have more. And I collectively refer to all these as the honeymoon effect, this equivalent of finding heaven on earth. And what's really interesting about it is that why I bring it up as the main topic, it doesn't have to be falling in love with another person, which is, we should emphasize that right now, a person who is a gardener, a person who is an artist, some other creative aspect. When people are engaged in these activities, they have all the same consequences as falling in love with somebody else. They're healthier, they're happier, life is beautiful for them, and the energy that they have to put into these efforts is just overwhelming. So the concept of creating this experience, and I think that's the emphasis here, Eva, is that I say right up until you met, let's say, this individual, your life was, oh, my God, it's not working, and blah, 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 and life is not fun, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden you meet this person. It's like, wow, life is so fabulous. Unfortunately for most, this honeymoon period is not long-lived, and it seems to go away. And why this is important is these two facts, Eva, which are related to the work that you do as well, is that, A, creating that honeymoon effect was not a coincidence, accident, or chance, that we actually manifested it. And when we lose it, again, not a coincidence, accident, or chance, we lose it because of processes involving our consciousness. The simple conclusion of all that is, if we understand the mechanism of how we created it, and we understand the mechanism as to why we lost it, then clearly, with that awareness, we can manifest a honeymoon experience that lasts every day of our life on this beautiful planet, and that's the emphasis. So it's to give people an insight that they are creators. And if you understand how you create, then you have choices. You can create everyday life, or you can create heaven on earth.
Can you, let me see here, can you go into how we create it or not, go down the rabbit hole a little bit on that?
Yeah, well, the first thing is this. Let's ask, why do we look for love in our life? Why do we look for relationships? And even if we keep failing at it, we still keep looking for it. So let's understand that there's a natural drive to find relationships for this following reason. All living organisms are endowed with something called the biological imperative. The biological imperative, although scientists can't localize where it is in the organism, it represents a set of behaviors that ensure to keep us alive, to keep us in a way to survive. And so when I talk about the biological imperative, those are the drives that people express unconsciously. Like if your body needs water, you get thirsty, you seek water. If your body needs energy, you get hungry, you seek food. If your body needs a better climate to be in rather than in too cold or too hot, you will seek an environment to allow your survival. So these are survival-driven behaviors. Well, the biological imperative actually has two aspects to it: the survival of the individual, like each one of us, all the things that we need to do to stay alive. But the second part of the imperative is survival of the species. And the significance about that is, well, the survival of the individual has to do with the drives of just maintaining our own biology. Survival of the species requires that we mate and produce offspring that will be able to survive. So we are driven to not only just take care of our own biology, but unconsciously we are driven to find relationships with the biological intention of creating offspring that allows the survival of the species. So we have this behavior built into us. And there's levels of this behavior that are controlled below the mind, and there are levels that are involved with the mind. And so let's go back as to why would we seek a honeymoon experience? What is nature pushing us into the honeymoon experience? Why would nature even care? So I go, let's go back to a primitive organism. Let's say two frogs. Two frogs come together, and with the right hormones, estrogen and testosterone, at the right time, and they're elicited in regard to what's going on in the world, in regard, for example, the climate and daylight hours. These are involved with causing these chemicals to be released at the right time for reproduction. Two frogs come together. They mate. And interestingly enough, after they mate, they don't sit around, have a cigarette and a glass of wine and you know, talk to each other lovingly. They mate, they're gone. And the relevance about that is simple, is that when a frog egg is fertilized, it's capable of developing on its own. The tadpole will hatch out of the egg, and the tadpole is already built in with the innate ability to survive. So two frogs don't need to be parents in this case at all. They just need to come together and generate the offspring. But as you go up higher, up the evolutionary scale, the more advanced organisms, when they're born, they're not complete or independent. And as a result, there's a period of after the reproduction part where parents are necessary to protect and guide and educate these organisms, the very young organisms that are not capable of taking care of themselves, and are there long enough so that the organisms at least reach an opportunity to become independent. So we say, like, okay, a chicken has these baby chicks, and she will be the mother and show them how to hunt for food and with all these other things by her behavior. They copy that. And it doesn't take very long, so a couple of weeks into after the hatching process, the chicks are pretty much capable of taking care of themselves. So the mother is not needed at that point anymore. The chicks are independent. I go, well, that's cool. But then when I say, when we come to a human, when the baby is born, it's clearly not capable of taking care of itself at all. And I said, well, how long does it take a human baby to reach a state of independence? Well, conventionally and historically, we would say that by around 13 years or so, 14 years or so, a child should have acquired enough abilities and information to be capable of surviving. Well, why that's important is that the first thing is this. Not only do two adult parents mate and create an offspring, but by design of nature, they should be available for 13 or 14 years to guide and help the development of this child until it reaches independence. And that would be fulfilling the requirements of the biological imperative. Well, now you have to say, well, what would encourage two people to stay together for that long? And then I say, because nature designed a system that rewards the parents for staying together. And this is built into our biology. So the aspect of seeking a relationship and then finding one that leads to reproduction is then followed by nature's design to keep the parents together for that period, at least 13 or 14 years, until the child is self-sufficient. So this is the reason why we're driven into relationships. Why we find these relationships and how we maintain them is all built into the biological imperative.
It makes me want to go down a path about why we fail in picking out the right thing, but I'm going to resist doing that.
Well, we're going to certainly have to touch on that for sure, because if it worked perfectly, then we'd have a perfect world, and our perfect world is not so perfect as we well know.
All right, I'm going to give you free rein, as long as you promise that you'll save me 20 minutes to ask you about genetics at the end.
Yes, I surely will. So let's go back and say, okay, so how does nature encourage us to stay together? Well, here's the beautiful part, is that nature provides us with emotions and sensory experiences. And nature knows that one of the things we really love is pleasure, because when we're in pleasure, the system is, you know, gravitating toward the source of that pleasure. So here's an interesting aspect, that when two people come together and they really find that their relationship is going along, that there's more pleasure built into the relationship. The tighter the relationship, the more pleasure is manifest. This is a result of a secretion of an emotional hormone called dopamine. So when you fall in love and you feel your body with all this pleasure going on, like, oh, wow, this is what I want, this is what I like, I'm driven to that, it's because the action of falling in love and finding a potential partner causes the release of dopamine in the body, and the dopamine gives us a sensation of pleasure and happiness and all that kind of stuff. Well, that wonderful character of harmony is a drive force in our behavior. We seek that. That's what we're looking for. And at the same time, we're seeking that with our relationship. Another very important chemical is released by the brain when we find this relationship, and that is called vasopressin. Well, vasopressin causes us to become more sexually active and also more attractive. And so we become more attractive and our partners become more attractive when we fall into this love because of the release of vasopressin. So this allows us to, A, come together and then have greater desire and appreciation for each other, A, the pleasure from dopamine, B, the attractiveness of the relationship as manifest by vasopressin. One of the other characteristics of falling in love, encouraged by nature, is that the experience of love and the dopamine and the vasopressin also cause the body to release another very important hormone called growth hormone, which, as the name says, this hormone encourages the growth and vitality of the 50 trillion cells that make up our body. So when you fall in love, you get healthier and you're happier. And the health aspect is mediated by this surge of growth hormone that is released when we find this partner. And this is why, simply, people glow when they fall in love. Yeah, they glow. They're healthier because nature is encouraging. So all of this behind the scenes chemical releasing going on is nature's way of saying, A, you found the partner you're looking for. B, you really become attracted to this partner that you're looking for. C, you're healthier than you've ever been. And all of these are saying, okay, stick with this individual. And in addition to make sure that we stick to that individual, nature releases another special hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin is called the bonding hormone. And basically it says whoever causes the release of oxytocin in your body is an individual that you want to bond with. Now, in the adult relationship, that's between the parents. But interestingly enough, another very important time that oxytocin is released into our body is when you're an infant and you're nursing. What happens, interestingly enough, when a child is nursing, the mother, in the process of nursing, releases oxytocin, and the baby, in the process of nursing, releases oxytocin. And guess what? The bond between the child and the mother is now stronger because oxytocin, the bonding hormone, says, this is where you're going to get your source from, and the pleasure that comes from it is going to be encouraged, and the bonding is between these two that elicit the release of that oxytocin. So when you're older and you're looking for a partner, and you have now the pleasure, we have the attractiveness, we have the extra health from the growth hormone and all that, nature then says, okay, I pick you as the one that I'm going to be a partner with for this reproduction business, and I'm going to stay with you. Why? Because look at all the pleasure and health that I derive from being in this. So this is below consciousness. It has nothing to do with consciousness in the sense that it's created by your effort. This is a chemical release behavior below the level of consciousness that assures that the individual that you end up selecting is the one you want to be with. And then the last one that just sort of seals the case is that the last involvement of a major hormone in this relationship is serotonin. And serotonin is the addiction hormone. If a heroin addict is getting high on their heroin, then serotonin is released in the process of shooting up with the heroin. And the relevance about that is very simple. The serotonin says, I want that. And I want that, and I want that, and I want that. So as long as the serotonin is being released in relation to some event, that event becomes an addiction. And it could be, as I said, heroin, but we also find out that love, a love relationship with the pleasure, attractiveness, the health, the bonding, is sealed by the fact that when people fall in love, the love experience causes serotonin to be released, so we become addicted to that love. And the addiction aspect really stands out when you fall out of love. If you fall out of love, there's like the same thing that happens when an addict goes cold turkey. It hurts a lot. It really says, no, don't do this. You know, go back in there, get some more of this stuff. And it, you know, it leads to sometimes very unfortunate psychological problems like stalking and stuff like that, is a person cannot let go of where they were getting the serotonin release from. And but the
that
whole idea was
fascinating.
It's interesting because we're driven. It's not like, okay, this is on the page and this is what I do now and this is what I do now. This is like happening under the radar and you don't even realize it, but you're being pulled into this relationship. And why? Because they said, yeah.
I'll tell you something that it makes me think about over the years. I'm a person that I'm a deep thinker, and I'm a people watcher kind of thing, and I listen to people. And one of the things that I've come to think over the years is that men and women think that the opposite sex is different. But when you think about everything that you just said, well, they think that the opposite sex doesn't love the same way. You know, I don't know if that makes
sense. Well,
there's
a thinking part, and that, we're going to come back to that, because let's emphasize they think that, and we'll come back to that, because that's where the tricky part comes in.
To listen to you, it's kind of like evidence that everybody loves the same until the mind part comes, the thinking part comes in.
Absolutely. It's all driven, again, just as much as you will go seek water if you are thirsty. Hey, it's 3 o'clock. I should have a glass of water. No, no, you have a drive at some moment that says, oh, God, I'm thirsty. I need some water. The drive will get you to that water. And the drive that we just talked about between all those secretions is the drive that nature says, look, I need you to reproduce because that's your biological imperative to keep the species alive, not just keeping you alive. But I need you to stay together for 13 or 14 years. Give me a reason why I want to do that. And the answer is because you're healthier, you're happier, you're energized, and it feels so good. And lastly, it's an addiction.
Very interesting. Okay. So now come into the thinking part of it. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, the thinking part comes into it in the story is that we have to understand that the mind is going to make a lot of decisions based on what's going to happen here. So we defer to the mind to help us create the relationship. I said, well, how do you know how to create a relationship? And the answer is, when you were an infant, you studied relationship without knowing it because you were in a state of hypnosis. The first 7 years of a child's life, the brain is operating predominantly at a low frequency called theta. Theta is imagination. So this is why it's a characteristic of children below 7 years of age, to mix the real world and the imaginary world, because their brain is operating at this state of imagination. So when you want the broom and the child is riding the broom and it's calling it a horse, you say, give me the broom. The child looks at you like, I don't know what you're talking about. I got my horse. This is my horse. At that moment, to that child, they have taken the imagination aspect of theta and turned that broom into a horse. And for them, at that moment, it's a horse, period. So theta is great. It's imagination, and this is a characteristic of children under seven, to mix these real and imaginary worlds together. But most importantly, theta is hypnosis. And you say, well, why should a child's brain be in hypnosis for 7 years? And then we step back and say, let's consider this. How many rules does it take for an individual to become a functional member of a family, a community, and a culture? I mean, if I had a book of rules, how do you respond? How do you behave? How do you do, what do you need to do, whatever, to become a functional element in this community? There'd be a list of rules. It'd be a giant book. And I say, well, how are you going to teach a child all of these things? You know, here's a child, it's 1 year old. Let's sit down and read a book about how to be a member of family. Obviously, this isn't going to help anybody. So nature facilitates by putting the child's brain into a state of hypnosis. The significance is it doesn't require any consciousness on the part of the child to learn anything. All it has to do is observe. And what it observes, it downloads as behaviors into the subconscious mind. The relevance about this necessity of the download is simply this. Let's say we go to the Apple store, we buy a brand new iPod. And when you take the iPod out of the box, there's that little ring on the front they call the click wheel. And the click wheel is used to make a playlist. Yeah, I want to play this, and I want to play that, and I want to stop and start and pause. I want to control. And so the control is the click wheel. Well, I say, imagine the click wheel as being the conscious mind, and the iPod then, here's a brand new iPod, it just came out of the box, and I say, okay, push play. And you push play, and nothing happens. and everybody in the audience when I bring this up, of course, says, of course, you didn't download any programs. I go, precisely. In order for you to be creative and to be conscious, which is the creative character of the mind, is the conscious mind, in order for you to be conscious, you have to have programs. If you don't have any programs, there's nothing to be conscious of. I mean, consider this. A child is just being born, and consider the possibility that it could speak the instant it was born. So the baby's coming out of the birth canal, is looking around, and you ask the baby, you say, tell me something. And the baby will look up at you and go, I don't know anything, I just got here. So basically, in order to be conscious, like the iPod, in order to create a playlist, you better have some programs in there so you can create. A blank subconscious offers no creativity. So nature designs the first 7 years to download programs just as much as you would download music in the iPod, so now you can make a playlist. Nature allows the brain to download behaviors for 7 years. Well, we have to recognize a very important part of this, which is really lost on the general population. And that is, well, then it says that the programs of how to live in this world and to behave in this world are fundamentally downloaded into our subconscious mind by observing other people, our parents, our siblings, our community. And I say, well, why is that relevant? Because we're downloading their behaviors. That's not our creation. That's not to acknowledge the conscious mind as different. And let's put it this way. The conscious mind is unique from the subconscious mind in this regard. The conscious mind is connected to you, your spirit, your source, your personal identity, your uniqueness. That's where we as individuals stand out. It's in the conscious mind. The conscious mind is the source of who we are. And the conscious mind is the creative mind. That's what makes humans above most of the lower organisms. Lower organisms, their lives are like stimulus response, input, output, is reflex behavior. And then when you get to humans, because we have a conscious mind, creative, between the stimulus and the output, humans can create a whole bunch of different things. So we're not strictly reflexive anymore. We can create different responses and behaviors and all that, but that comes from the creative conscious mind. And yet, I say the conscious mind, in order to be creative, at least has to have some programs in it. So the first 7 years of a child's life is the downloading of the behaviors that allow us to become a functional member of family and a society. And the problem is that the downloaded behaviors are downloaded before consciousness is a functional state of the child's brain. Relevant? The programs that we download into our subconscious that get us off the ground and help us become a member of the society are programs that didn't come from us and don't express our creative wishes and desires. They're copying other people's behaviors. So when you push the button on the subconscious to play a behavior, the fundamental behaviors in the subconscious that are going to come out don't represent what we have in our creative list of wishes and desires. So the conscious mind, source of wishes, desires, and aspirations, is really based on the programs that we got in the subconscious mind, but those programs came from other people. Now let's put all the pictures together here, and it goes like this, that the subconscious mind is downloaded with behaviors before we become conscious. And when we become conscious, we can operate from those behaviors. But with our creativity, we can alter and change those behaviors as well. That's the unique part. And so we're pretty much clear on that. And then I'm going to add one more part, and then we'll put the story back together, Eva. It goes like this. The conscious mind, not only just being creative, the conscious mind is capable of thinking. And why that's relevant is, if I ask you a simple question right now, Eva, I just say, what are you doing next Friday? The moment I ask you that question, your conscious mind goes into thought. I'm thinking, okay, let me think of what I'm doing next Friday. And I go, yeah. And here's what also happens. When the conscious mind is engaged in thinking, by definition, it's not paying attention to what's going on around it. So by definition, you take your conscious mind off paying attention to the current moment, put it in your head, thinking, what am I doing on Friday? Go through your little Rolodex of, this is what I'm doing on Friday. You come back, you tell me what you're doing on Friday, and I'm going to tell you, between the time I asked you the question and the time you came up with an answer, your conscious mind was not paying attention to what was going on around us. And
so can I ask a question?
Yes, please do.
Where are you most likely to be able to create or manipulate reality, when you're thinking or when you're not thinking?
In your thinkingness. This is because the nature of the conscious mind's thinking process, okay? Because the definition of the conscious mind is the creative mind. So okay. If you want to plan a future, you go into your conscious mind. And as I said, it's not planning from a blank slate. It's based on also all your life experiences and all the downloaded programs. So your conscious mind is not just creating out of nothing. It's really reflecting on its life experiences and its
history. Okay, let me ask one more question then.
Yes.
Because I might not have phrased it the right way. So we create, we may get the idea or the formula or whatever when we think, but how do we actually... Where are we most likely to have it project out into physical reality and form, create the matter, the new car or whatever it is? In the thinking mind, after we create it, or in the other part?
What's the other part?
The not thinking?
No, the creative part has to have the intention. If there's no intention built into that, it doesn't go anywhere. That's
okay.
Daydream.
So the thinking part is what actually manipulates molecules and causes them to become cohesive, and eventually, if that's the big picture, form into something in physical reality. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, if you don't have the conscious mind working, which and we're going to come to that in a second. If you don't have the conscious mind working, then that means your behavior is controlled by the programs that already exist. Well, then I go, well, the problem with that is then you can, it's only playback. There's no creativity. If this is the way you learned how to do something when you were an infant and you're not paying attention, your subconscious runs the show, it's going to play back the exact same program, and you will repeat this behavior over, over, and over for the rest of your life unless you change that program. So basically, the issue is this. As I said, we're walking down the street. You have a creative thought coming into your head. Well, that means at that moment of creativity, you're not really paying attention. So does that mean you just stop walking? You're walking, you have a thought. Does that mean you just freeze, let the thought complete itself, and then as you bring your consciousness back to the moment again, then you start walking? No. Here's the important fact. When the conscious mind is thinking, it doesn't mean we stop whatever we're doing, walking, doing a job that you do a lot, talking to somebody else, driving the car. It doesn't mean the moment your conscious mind leaves the current moment that everything stops, because here's the issue. When the conscious mind is busy, the default is the subconscious programming. So if you're walking down the street and you have a thought, that doesn't mean you have to be conscious of your walking. Why? The subconscious can do the walking. The subconscious can drive the car. It drives better than the conscious mind because it's a million times more powerful. So the issue is this. When the conscious mind is thinking, behavior is now controlled by the subconscious program. And this creates a problem, and we're going to talk about this problem later as we expand on the honeymoon effect, and that is this. When my conscious mind is thinking, and here's the number that this is, okay, let's wake up here, because here's the number. Scientists reveal that 95% or more of our behavior is controlled by the subconscious mind, because the conscious mind is engaged in thinking 95% of the time. So the relevance is our lives, we think, are being controlled by our conscious mind, wishes, desires, aspirations. I go, yeah, well, it is, if your conscious mind's in control. And then I go, yeah, but science says your conscious mind's only in control 5% of the time, because the rest of the time it's involved with thinking. And then the default is the subconscious is controlling the system when the conscious mind's thinking. So you're only controlling, this is like the scary part, you're only controlling your life with your intentions, your wishes, your desires, your aspirations 5% of the time. 95% of the time, our behavior is being played by the subconscious mind, which means unconscious. And I go, well, the significance of that, and I present this to the audience, and they all laugh because they have personal experience with it. I go, look, I'm sure you were close to a friend, and if you were growing up, you knew your friend's behavior very, very well, and you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day, you see that your friend has some of the exact same behavior as their parent, and in the excitement of recognizing this, you volunteer something like, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill, because Bill goes totally ballistic. How can you compare me to my dad? And everyone laughs because they're familiar with it. And I say, let me tell you how this could be the most profound story I can offer for this reason. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. I say, well, how to explain that? And I go, simple. In the childhood, first 7 years, he observed his father's behavior, downloaded his behavior by strictly observing it in a state of hypnosis while the brain was in theta. So the programs in his fundamental subconscious programming were primarily derived from his father. And I go, yeah, and here's the issue. When he's thinking, his conscious mind disconnects from the current moment while in thought. But while his conscious mind is disconnected, his life is still continuing because we default to the subconscious program. Well, that's his dad's behavior. And then I say, but why doesn't Bill see it? And the answer is, because his conscious mind's not paying attention. When your mind's in thought, you're not paying attention. So whatever behavior is coming out, you're the one that doesn't see it, but everybody else sees it. And the issue why this story is so important is that we are all Bill. Every one of us plays subconscious programs 95% of the day, and most of it is invisible, because as the program is playing itself out, the reason why it's playing is the conscious mind's not paying attention. So we have a life, wishes, desires, and we live 95%, not from that part, the conscious mind, but from the programs that we acquired during the first 5 years, 7 years, actually. And I say, why is that relevant? Because those programs include every aspect of our life. How to have a relationship. How do you know how to have a relationship? Observe your parents. They're programming you. Their behavior on how they relate to each other and how they respond to each other is unconsciously being downloaded into your subconscious mind in the first 7 years. That means when you're not paying attention, the behavior in a relationship that you would exhibit will not necessarily be anything of your wishes and desires, but it will be what your parents display. So now, if we put all those pieces together, here's a given fact. We have been programmed, and that these programs run 95% of our lives. And most of the time, these programs are invisible when we are running them. And then I say, so then the story that most people have seen, the movie The Matrix, it's very interesting. In my lecture, I say, well, you know, The Matrix, I say, where do you find this movie in the video store? And somebody would say, oh, go look in the science fiction department. And then I would say, wrong. The Matrix is a documentary. We've all been programmed. And that our lives, 95% of it, are manifesting the programs and the consequences of those programs. And these behaviors are not ours. So here's the disconnect in our lives. I have this great intention, this great wish, this great desire to be totally in love, to live heaven on earth, to be healthy, to be happy, to have great relationships, to have a great job. I go, great. This is the total characteristic of the conscious mind. Creativity, wishes, desires, and aspirations. And we go forth in the morning, and we say, yeah, I'm going out to succeed. And then you come home in the evening, tail between your legs, going, oh, my God, I didn't get anywhere today. I didn't get to where I was going. I had these great wishes. Look what happened. And here's the problem. We didn't get there because that wasn't a destination we were able to get to. We didn't get there because 95% of the day, while we were thinking about our wishes and our desires and all those things, we were operating under the subconscious programming, which was other people's behavior. They didn't match my wishes and desires, so that behavior will not lead me to my wishes and desires. And most importantly, that behavior, by definition, is invisible. Why? Because I was thinking when I was playing those things, and I'm the one that didn't see it. So if you have a sabotaging program, and you know, God, psychologists will tell you this, 70% of those programs during that developmental period are negative, disempowering, and self-sabotaging. So the fact is, that means 70% of the 95% of the day, the behaviors you're expressing are not going to get you towards your destination. And you're not going to see them. That leads us to the biggest problem on this planet today. And that is, you come home in the evening, you didn't get there, you started out with all these intentions, you didn't see you were involved. What are you left to understand about why it didn't work? And the answer was, oh, I'm a victim. I'm a victim of reality, of nature, of fate, whatever it was. Why? Because I wanted to be successful. I didn't get there, so it wasn't me. I was the one that wanted to go there, and it didn't work. So it must be outside. And that leaves us as a total population to perceive of ourselves as victims of fate, that it's not in my fate to find that relationship because I've been looking for it, but I can't find it, so therefore it's not there. And it turns out, no, my God, it's sort of like if one of our programs is to shoot ourselves in the foot. So we go out all day long thinking, I'm going out to be successful, and then you come home and you got this big bloody foot. You look down at your foot and go, oh, my God, who the heck shot me in the foot? And the simple reality was, well, all day long you didn't see it, but 95% of that day, boom, you were shooting yourself. But you didn't see it, victim. So we've been programmed. The programs are not supporting us 70% of the time. And I say, well, you're going out and looking for this love. But one day, all of a sudden, you find this individual, and guess what? It all works. Life works. And it's beautiful. You're in love. And you are finding life is so beautiful. You're healthy. You're energized. Life is so wonderful. And I go, how'd that happen? What happened? So I go back to the story of the Matrix. And in the story of the Matrix, not only were we programmed, but we have an opportunity in that story where they say you got two pills here. You can take the blue pill or the red pill. The blue pill, you take that, you go back into the program, and life is just the way it's always been. So no life change. Everything's exactly the same. But then the red pill is offered. And it says, yeah, the red pill will take you out of the program. I say, well, what's the consequence of taking the red pill? And the answer, it now turns out that science has recognized when you fall in love, like we were talking about, it's the one time in your life, and it's done unconsciously, that you stay mindful. You keep your conscious mind in the front. It's not the 5% now. It's working, science says, up to 90% or more of your behavior is now controlled by your conscious mind. Simple reason, why would you let your mind wander when everything you were ever seeking is in front of your face? And all of a sudden it's like, wow, I keep my conscious mind present. I go, well, why is that relevant? Because now, instead of just 5% of the day, I'm creating my life 90% of the day with wishes and desires. And when two people are operating in harmony, both creating from wishes and desires and not deferring to the subconscious programs, they manifest wishes and desires. And that's when the honeymoon gets off the ground. And this is so cool because all of your behavior now in this period called the honeymoon is really based on your wishes and desires because we're not defaulting to the program. It's the equivalent of taking the red pill. Got out of the program? What'd you do? Heaven on earth. And then, so just closure on this is, okay, I've created heaven on earth. Why? I'm operating from wishes and desires of my creative mind, and I'm not defaulting to the negative programming. The subconscious, I go, really great. And then life goes on, and we're in love, but then guess what? Life is very busy. No matter how much you're in love, you still got to, you know, pay the rent, fix the car, do the chores. I go, why is that relevant? Because the moment you start thinking about paying the rent and fixing the car and doing the chores, the moment you're thinking about those things, recognize this. Your conscious mind is now taken off the current moment. Your conscious mind is means your behavior is now coming from your subconscious. Yeah, but the programs of relationships and how to be in a wonderful, harmonious relationship with a partner, you're not operating from wishes and desires on that. Now you're operating from the behaviors that you learned from your parents, your family, and your community. And you're using these behaviors, and you're the one that doesn't even see you're doing it. Your partner can see it, just like everyone can see that Bill is behaving like his dad, except for Bill. So let's go to the scenario. And the scenario is this. We're in a honeymoon. Life is beautiful. Every day we're manifesting heaven on earth during this period. We're healthy. Yeah, all the great chemicals running through the body to keep us healthy. We're in love. Yeah, all the great chemicals that keep us bonded together, seeking the pleasure and addicted to that pleasure, working. Everything is really, really great. Then we start thinking. And so let's put it this way. Let's say my wonderful partner, Margaret, comes up. We're having a great honeymoon thing. And she asked me a very simple, loving question. But at that moment, I'm in thought. I got to fix the car. And so I'm thinking about fixing the car. She asked me a question. I turn to her and go, blah, blah, blah. And she looks at me like, and I love the phrase because it's universal. She looks at me and says, who are you? All of a sudden, like, where did that behavior come from? Okay, now we got a problem. Here's where the problem comes from. Just like Bill, I just played my father's behavior, but I didn't see it. I didn't see I was involved at all. And now my loving partner, we've had this great relationship, is accusing me of myself not being me. And all of a sudden, I get a very defensive posture. I go, what are you talking about? I've always been this way. Well, that, yeah, well, in one sense, yeah, but my partner never seen that way. Why? Because I, up till now, had not defaulted to the programming that I got from my parents because I stayed conscious. Now that my mind's busy, I start unloading programs of behavior that I got from other people, which throw a monkey wrench in the relationship, and I'm the one that didn't see it. So when I'm being accused of the problem, you are the problem, it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And this leads to a loss of communication between the two people, number one. Number two, it brings up a very unfortunate situation as well, and that is this. The behavior that I just played, for example, that I got from my father, if I had played that on our first date, that behavior, I may not have had a second date. My partner would have said, geez, that's really crummy. I don't want to hang around with anybody like that. But I never played that behavior. I've had the honeymoon. She's had the honeymoon. We're working this thing out. It's really great. Then I play this behavior. She stops, goes, oh, my God, you know, that was nasty. should I stay here? And then the mind goes through the calculation and says, wow, everything else about our relationship is wonderful. Okay, so this is not so great. This is a part of my partner that is not so great, so I'll compromise. Okay, this happens sometimes. But we still have this other relationship going on. Well, the moment you compromise and accept this invisible behavior that I just offered, then what you're doing is you're accepting less than your wishes and desires. And every time a new behavior comes in, both from my part and from her part, because she's involved in the world too, so she's going to play her mother's behavior preferentially. And at some point, if our parental behaviors were not really very good, then we are torpedoing a relationship one new subconscious behavior at a time. One compromise, another compromise, then another compromise. At some point, the juiciness, the joy, the energy and enthusiasm of the honeymoon is being dissipated bit by bit as these subconscious programs that were never part of the honeymoon but now start showing up, sabotage that honeymoon. And neither partner had any awareness, just like Bill, that they were even involved in all this. So everybody's lost. And if too many compromises happen, and the inevitable result is the relationship cannot be sustained. And then all of a sudden, here are two people that break up after this relationship and have to think about, how did something that started out so beautiful get lost? And the answer was, it started out with the interaction of two conscious minds as the relationship. Conscious minds that shared wishes and desires and manifested them. But the relationships then start to fall apart when two uncalled for, unwanted subconscious minds enter into the story, for the simple reason they introduce behaviors that do not necessarily match the wishes and desires and aspirations that are present in our creative conscious mind. They undermine the relationship. And as a result of that, then there's greater separation, disconnection. Now, it doesn't mean everybody gets a divorce and all that, but what it means is you could still love your partner, but, God, somewhere along the line, that special part of the honeymoon, the juiciness, the excitement, the desire, it's interesting because serotonin is also compulsive behavior. And it's interesting because when we're falling in love, and the serotonin is addicting us to it, it also brings on very compulsive behavior. That's why when you first fall in love, all day long you keep thinking of your partner, even if you're at the job or you're at the store, wherever you are, you are compulsively thinking of your partner. And when this begins to fall apart, that's when the disconnects come. And then we're left with a final conclusion, which is simple.
We have 1 minute.
Oh my God! Oh, how did we?
Sorry, I'm fascinated. I just couldn't help it. I had to keep listening.
Well, just very quickly, how did we create the honeymoon effect? We operated for the first time in mindfulness, and manifested the wishes and desires of the creative conscious mind. How come we lose the honeymoon effect? Because consciousness gets involved with everyday life, starts to disconnect, go into thought, we start playing the subconscious programs, and as psychologists say, most of those are negative and as a result will not support the relationship. And then there's the one last aspect of that, and simply is this. We are capable of rewriting the subconscious program. And the simple consequence of that is, imagine the result of rewriting the limiting programs in your subconscious mind and replacing them with programs that express your wishes, desires, and aspirations. And the simple conclusion is this. Whether you're in your conscious mind manifesting the wishes and desires, or whether you default to the subconscious mind, you still be manifesting wishes and desires. And all of a sudden you start to see that a honeymoon experience as designed by nature could last every day of your life while you're on this beautiful planet.
You are fabulous, Dr. Bruce Lipton. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. And you can find his information at brucelipton.com. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Thank you, Eva.
Okay, hold on, Bruce. He had to go. He's going to cut this off. He had to go to the doctor. Something's wrong with his ear.
Oh.
Thank you so much for taking time for me. I know that you're so busy.
Oh,
I really appreciate this.
I appreciate what you do. I appreciate your work, and thank you for including me on this platform to talk to your audience. Thank you.
I wonder sometime, and again, I know you're busy, I would love to talk to you about really about epigenetics and do a show on that and genetics. Because you know that genetic testing and all the hype on MTHFR, people really don't know if they don't know about that stuff. They think the solutions in a shot of folic acid or a shot of B12 is going to fix everything.
Yeah, they're being ripped off.
Would you be able? Would you have any time to do a show on that any time in the next 6 months?
Well, let's set it up with Sally in the office, let's say that I said yes right now. Let's arrange a future time within that time period so we can do this, because to me that's the most important thing, because that genetic testing implies that we are victims of our genes, which is completely false, and we can rewrite anything. So there's very little use for genetic testing, and here's the problem with it, though. People have belief about genes controlling their lives, and if they buy the belief that this is a negative gene, it's going to have a negative impact, then the negative belief will manifest itself, irregardless of the gene.
What I would like to do is, I've been doing a lot of interviews, technical interviews on this topic in the last year and a half, I'd say. And I have a group of people. I don't know if you know Amy Yatsko, Steve Sinatra, guy named Bill Walsh, guy named Ralph Holdsworth. All of these people are either MDs or PhD researchers. Mm-hmm. And this is their focus. But the key to all of these people is that they're all open to new information.
Yeah,
so
well,
they know their little topics. Like Bill Walsh's topic is, I mean, his area of expertise is he's a chemical engineer. So he does nutrient therapy to target genes. And look him up. Look up his stuff. And then Amy is a geneticist, and she's also doing nutrigenomics, specifically with kids with autism and spectrum disorder. And Ralph Holdsworth's doing it from a perspective of heart disease. So I would like to be able to sit down and do a focused preparation for an interview so that I could literally depose you, asking you questions that I know would help each one of these scientists with their research so that they could go to the next level. You could provide them with information, because I know what their research is and I know how they think, so I could ask you questions that when they hear your interview, they go, oh, frack, I can use that and change what I'm doing this way.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
I would love to do that. Absolutely, because when you're trained as a geneticist, then the perception that you look at the world is through the glasses of genetics, okay? So there's, unfortunately, no matter if you try to get outside the box, you're still in the genetics box.
Yeah.
And the relevance about that is, oh my God, I have to mechanically interact in some way to offset this mechanical gene, when the fact is no. But that's a belief system. And the issue is, thought will rewrite the genes.
I suspect with these interviews that I'm doing, eventually I may put out another book targeting the doctors and the researchers so that they see where each one of them are coming from, and then they see what you have to say, and they go, oh, my God, I can completely... You know, there's another whole level to what I'm doing, and I think that you could make the difference, because if they could hear your answer. So I would love that. I'd be grateful.
Love that. So let's set it up, and I'll tell Sally that we're expecting an email from you for another time, and to see where and when she could put it in to make sure we can finish this. Okay.
And you might have to help me design the questions so that we can fit them all in an hour. Just like a deposition. Have you ever given a deposition?
but not for this kind of stuff.
Well, because we only have an hour, so we have to do very targeted things to pull out the information that we need.
Let's get on a phone call when we're ready to start putting the questions down and work it out before the interview.
Okay.
So that, as you said, we don't, waste a valuable hour time. Okay?
That would be great. Because these people, they're spiritually awake, and they're thirsty for the new information. It's a great opportunity to enhance. Thank you. And I'll get in touch with Sally.
Oh, wonderful. I appreciate it.
Take care, my dear, and I'm grateful for you.
Thank you.
Have a good
one.
for
the opportunity, Eva, and I look forward to our future getting together.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.